history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories out there that really ought to be told, and we're never going to hear them unless we take the time to ask a few questions and listen to what comes back our way. I think you're in for a treat today as we seek to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And as we take that journey, we learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, and so often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Today I'm in Las Vegas, Nevada with 94-year-old Gloria Saucier. And I say 94, but I just don't believe it. You don't seem like you act 94. Gloria, what's your secret?
Eat your vegetables. I don't know.
Here, I thought you were the cookie lady.
Yes. Well, that helps. And have a lot of friends. If you can help them out, help them. I do a lot for veterans, and I think they've done so much for us, really. I was never overseas, so I don't think I should really consider myself as a veteran. But the ones that were overseas and had active duty, I think those are the ones that we should really be concerned about and, you know, do what we can do.
Well, I'm sure our listeners will form their own opinion after we hear your whole story. So let's start out with your childhood growing up in New Jersey. What was that like living through the Great Depression, which people today, some don't even know what it was?
It was actually my brother and I never enjoyed living during Depression, never enjoyed it so much. In order to save our home, we had to rent it out and move down to what you would call today a ghetto. And living in the ghetto, we learned to eat off, by imitation, of course, but to eat off tables of people that were Italian, Irish, Jewish, German. We all shared food. If we had food, we would share it one another. I had good times. I could tell you lots of stories about Depression. One quick little story is that we had to line up to get food, and you have to remember that this was in New Jersey, and we lined up, and I got a case of peaches, and on the outside of the box, I still remember this, was stencil, Folsom Prison, California. So here are the peaches were sent from the prison in California to New Jersey. That was sort of funny.
What kind of perspective did that give you? Because I imagine that there are probably some things you learned during those years that have stuck with you all the rest of these years.
Yes, it taught me to be able to consider other people in need, to share, to give whatever you can afford to give, and to learn to live with people of different nationalities, because basically we all have the same interests. We're interested in our families, our health, and we have so much in common. It actually, sometimes I would feel like it was one big nationality.
And you mentioned your brother. Now, I understand your brother was in the Navy before Pearl Harbor?
Yes, my brother was, and it was interesting because my mother was a Red Cross nurse during World War II, and my brother was in the Navy, and I was in the Marine Corps, and my father was an air raid warden. So we were the famous family of Elizabeth, New Jersey, and they had this huge, huge picture in the window of one of the department stores because we were a veterans family. Mm-hmm. But
you were the poster family. I mean, they had all four of you were doing something, so they wanted to make you an example?
Yes, yes. And it was quite an honor.
But before you became a Marine, December 7th, 1941 happened. And I bet you remember something about that day.
Yes. My brother was close to Pearl Harbor. Fortunately, he was on a destroyer escort, and they were able to get out of the harbor in time. So I was concerned about his health.
You probably heard about it on the radio or something?
Yes, we did. And I think the first reaction I think a lot of us got, we thought that the Japanese would come right over and conquer all of us. It was kind of scary. And then there were rumors of submarines coming into the Hudson River. They would be the German submarines.
Yeah.
But after a while, things calmed down a little bit.
Well, and the German submarines had been operating off the Atlantic coast, and I'm sure that was stuff you heard about even before Pearl Harbor, right?
Yes.
How real or palpable was that fear or concern that the Germans might attack right there where you lived?
Scared us to death.
Keep you up at night, that kind of thing?
No, but the neighbors would discuss it a lot, and we were quite worried. Yes, we were.
And did I catch correctly that even had a hand in where you had to go to take flight lessons?
Exactly. There was a 90-mile limitation of flying in New Jersey because of our proximity to the Hudson River. So in order, the closest place where we could learn to fly would be in Pennsylvania. And that would be along the Delaware River and a little town called Martin's Creek. That's where we learned to fly.
And what gave you this idea that you ought to be a pilot?
When I was about 12 or 13, I'm not sure, I lived in New Jersey. And I remember the planes coming into Newark for a landing. And for some reason, our home was on their last leg. And I remember the planes flying over, and I would sit on the rooftop, and I could see the lights being turned on. These were night flights. And the lights being turned on in the cabin of the plane. And little did I realize that one day I would possibly be turning those lights on. But I've always wanted to fly. I don't know why, but I just... And even now, even today, when I see a plane fly over, I have to look. I really do.
I know the feeling. So you're a teenager, and you want to fly, but I'm sure there's a lot of kids that have that idea. So how did you make that happen? What kind of hoops did you have to jump through to get that opportunity?
Well, I was very fortunate because the Civil Air Patrol was taking in very young people. When I say very young, maybe 14 to 16, and they would take them on their missions. And the Civil Air Patrol also taught ground school, and there was no charge for ground school. So I took the ground school in New Jersey, and that's when I started taking flying lessons.
So what did it feel like the first time you got up in the air and you had the controls?
Oh, it was funny, because the way they usually do it, the instructor, you have maybe 7-8 hours of time with your instructors, and you learn all the, you know, the different stalls and things, and they get you prepared for the solo. But anyway, I was in a tandem side-by-side plane. It was a Taylorcraft. My instructor came up one day and he said, "I just canceled my life insurance, so I'm not flying with you anymore. You're going to have to fly on your own." So I said, "Oh, okay." So I was doing takeoffs and landings, you know, all morning, so there was nothing to it. So I took off, made my first turn, and I turned over to talk to the instructor. He wasn't there. I did get scared. So I did 3 takeoffs and landings. And on my second one, I came in a little too high. So I had to slip it in and correct it. I felt badly about that. I found out later that my instructor was very happy about that because he thought if something happened, I knew how to handle it. But it was a big thrill. It really was. And I did some aerobatics. I flew with another pilot, and we did aerobatics in a biplane. And that was a lot of fun. And as you know, if you do the perfect 360 turn in a biplane, you can feel your own prop wash. So when you do, then you know that you did it right.
Well, and how old were you that first solo flight?
I was about 16. And the funny part about it, I was too young to drive a car. But I guess when you're young, you're fearless, and you don't think of these things. But it's a wonderful feeling to be flying up there and checking things out and being prepared if you have to make a forced landing and the things that they would tell you. Like, of course, you always have to fly into the wind, and you would have to look at a lake and see which way the ripples are going or the birds that are flying, you know, just to figure out which way the wind is blowing.
Well, and here we were just talking a minute ago about the Depression and eating food from other people in the neighborhood and eating pizzas sent from California, of all places. So I think the question comes up, how'd you pay for flight lessons? That couldn't have been easy.
No, it wasn't at all, because my parents didn't have the money. My brother, who was in the Navy, God bless him, would send me money. It cost $10 an hour, and they consider that wet, which means that's for the fuel. And it was through him that I was able to fly. He certainly did away with a lot of things by sending me all that money, that I realize. But I do remember him telling me, though, that he could buy a pack of cigarettes for 3 cents once he was out on the ocean.
Well, and so if you're flying at 16, did you have aspirations of maybe becoming a WASP and getting part of that program?
Absolutely. I wanted to get in the ferry command because I heard these gals were flying P-51s and P-38s, the Lightnings, you know. And, oh, what a thrill that would be. But unfortunately, the program was closed down before I could even apply. But I knew a lot of the gals. I flew with a lot of the gals that went ahead and became ferry pilots. I knew one gal, Pat Kensworthy. She was really tiny. She was like 5'2", 5'3". And it was hard for me to believe that she could fly a B-17 from Texas to England. They did remarkable things. They really did. I think they paved the way for women in aviation.
Without question. And there are other women doing other things in the war that paved the way for the future, too. And I'm sure you've run in a time or two to somebody who, when they find out that you served in the U.S. Marine Corps in World War II, they say, wait a second, there weren't any women in the Marine Corps in World War II? But there were. How did you find out about that program and become one of the really few, the really proud female Marines of World War II?
Well, I wanted to get close to aviation, and when the program had closed down, the WASP program closed down, I was trying to get something, and I felt I owed, well, I felt, shall I say, patriotic, or I had a responsibility, because we were at war, and when this Marine recruiter told me that I would be very acceptable, I just went ahead and joined up. I never, never regretted it. Boot camp was interesting. We had DIs, drill instructors. They were all men, and most of them were from Guadalcanal, active duty, and they hated the women. And they would tell us, we're going to march you to the river. And I tell you, we got our feet wet. We really did. We would never, ever not do. Or at midnight, this was in Camp Lejeune, North Carolina, where I took my boot camp training. And at midnight, we were out there among the pine trees picking up cigarette butts. And I was scared to death because I'm afraid of snakes. And I heard that there's a lot of snakes out there. But I'm so indebted to the Marine Corps. It allowed me to go to language school to learn French and Spanish. It allowed me to go to the University of New Mexico with the GI Bill, with something that was offered to us. And I learned how to follow orders. I learned history of the Marine Corps, which gave me a lot of pride. And even today, I feel very, very proud to be a Marine. I met many, many women in the Marine Corps, and I've kept up with a couple of them up until a few years ago. So anyway, I'm really beholden, and I'm glad I joined up.
Now, and I've met a few women Marines of World War II, and I've met a lot of male Marines of World War II, and you hear that once a Marine, always a Marine. And some guys have even told me that it just completely rewires their brain, that their whole mentality or view of themselves changes when they become a Marine. Was it that transformative for you?
Yes, it was. And I think part of it in the boot camp training, when you learn the history of the Marine Corps, you take on a different aspect, and you just can't help but feel very proud. Even today, if someone mentions, oh, were you in the service? I have to mention that I was in the Marine Corps, because I am proud. And whenever I see a fellow Marine or Marine wearing a cap, I always say Semper Fi, because that is a little signal that we have among ourselves. But yes, I was very lucky, and I'm grateful and thankful that I was able to be in the Marine Corps.
And we'll explore some of her World War II duties in the Marine Corps when we come back, plus how Gloria's love of aviation propelled her to a post-war career in the air, and how a recent honor flight brought her back to a familiar face from her past. Find photos of Gloria then and now at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this.